Well, I want to welcome Reagan Whitlock to the Florida Folk Show again, and appreciate having you come spend time to come down here. And you know things that we wouldn't be able to figure out unless you told us about them. But I know that all kinds of statistics have been flying out this year because of the 50th anniversary. For example, 21 species, including birds, a bat, and several mussels, have been labeled extinct in all this time, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And we were talking a little bit before the show. How does this particular law rank among conservation legislation laws that have worldwide?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me again. I'm happy to be here. The Endangered Species Act is a central component of what we work with in the Center for Biological Diversity, and I truly think it's probably our most important piece of environmental legislation. You know, it was passed 50 years ago this year. We're celebrating an anniversary, and it was amidst that large sweep of green legislation that was passed in the early 70s. You had the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and I think, most importantly, the Endangered Species Act.
All of them passed while Nixon.
Yes, exactly. And many of them unanimous. It's interesting to see where we've come.
Really, really. What is the status of the act now? I mean, are we still serious about it?
Absolutely. The act is alive and well. You know, there's certainly decisions made by our agencies that contradict the act, and that's why we have teams of litigators around. But by and large, this has been 50 years of success stories for the Endangered Species Act. The numbers and the statistics really bear it out. It's been seen to be 99% effective at preventing extinction for the species who are listed. Yeah. And it's credited with saving more than 200 species from extinction during its 50-year tenure. It's an incredible success story. I'm glad we had the foresight 50 years ago to pass it.
Absolutely. And not including the Florida panther, which was at the brink.
Absolutely. And the Florida manatee as well, one of the first species, the first mammal actually to be given Endangered Species Act protections.
I didn't realize it was the first mammal.
No,
that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's going on with the manatee right now? what's the progress on trying to get it relisted? Any updates, or how's that going?
There's a lot of updates, a lot going on. Many folks who are listening are likely familiar with the tumultuous last few years that the manatee has experienced. They're in the midst of what's known as an unusual mortality event that's now been going on for 3 years. And I think at a certain point we have to drop the unusual moniker, and it's just a mortality event. It was really peaking in 2021. We lost more than 1,100 Florida manatees in 2021 alone, and that's, you know, out of a population of only 8,000 or so. So quite a big number. Most of that fueled by the ecological collapse of the Indian River Lagoon, one of their, you know, favorite haunts, especially in the winter season. But also right here in Tampa Bay, we've lost a lot, especially in the wake of Piney Point, the release. But as you mentioned, the manatee was downlisted in 2017 during the Trump administration, during what the Fish and Wildlife Service was advancing as the wildly important goal. And what that goal was, in reality, was a directive to downlist, delist, or otherwise preclude Endangered Species Act protections for 30 species every year.
And what was the, like, rationale behind that move?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. It speaks to how politics and changing administrations can unfortunately influence agency decision making. And the manatee was a victim of that. You know, we told the service at the time that the manatee was on the brink of an unusual mortality event. We were seeing seagrass declines all across the state of Florida. And endangered species are not dissimilar from people in that regard. They have, in order to protect them, you have to protect their food and their homes. And we're losing both of those for the manatee at an alarming rate. We petitioned along with the Harvard Animal Law and Policy Clinic, Miami Waterkeeper, Frank Gonzalez Garcia, and Save the Manatee Club for the Fish and Wildlife Service to uplist the manatee back to endangered again. You know, one of the things that happened in 2017 was when we downlisted the manatee, it was a signal to our legislators that it's time to let the foot off the gas pedal. You know, allocations stopped. We lost folks in the manatee recovery teams for the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. It was a big step backwards in manatee recovery.
Who were the enemies of the manatee? I know that growing up, and I spent much of my boyhood in on the Indian River in Rockledge, and way back then, even before the Endangered Species Act, the fishermen and the boaters they were not friendly to the manatee because you're supposed to slow down, mm-hmm. you know, slow down, and they didn't want to do that, and so there's always a conflict there. I think over time, as the new people moved in and the place grew up a little bit, I think that kind of faded away. But still, the number of manatees that die in the Indian River, it's not so much by getting hit, but it's because of the lack of the seagrass.
Sure, and I will say that boater mortality is still a major issue for the manatees. You know, we lose around 100 manatees a year to boat strikes, and that pales into comparison to the amount of manatees that get hit every year. There's a study that 92% of manatees have at least one prop scar on them, and a quarter manatees have 10 prop scars or more.
Oh,
I mean, and most of the times you see one, you see it on their backs. You know what they've gone through. You know, there certainly is some conflict between the different communities, you know, the fishing and boating communities and the manatees, but I think by and large, folks who are out in the environment and see the species understands how special they are. You know, I don't think the conflict is overly great, but you know, one thing we see with the Endangered Species Act time and time again is it's a very strong piece of legislation. You know, it can prohibit development or at least modify development in order to satisfy, you know, species needs, and that inherently is going to receive some pushback. So there are stakeholders on every side of the coin here, and anytime you have a charismatic species that's been given the protections of the Endangered Species Act, you're gonna ruffle a few feathers, so to speak.
Now, did the manatee have a designated critical habitat?
Yes. So the manatee was one of the first species to get critical habitat designations back in the 70s. But unfortunately, the Endangered Species Act, or fortunately, the way you look at it, was amended after those designations to kind of bolster what critical habitat means. It's no longer just a list of places we know the species to exist. It also must include what the Act calls physical and biological features essential to the conservation of the species. And, you know, while that may be legal jargon, you can assume what those probably are. They're probably warm water habitats, seagrass, you know, they're home and food. And the manatee didn't have that in their designations. We petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2008 to update it. And in 2010, they told us that, yeah, it is warranted to update that, but precluded because of agency funding and other priorities, which is a significant issue you see time and time again with the service. And we certainly do hope that they get more resources. You know, I think we all can fight for that. So it took a lawsuit, and we were able to settle 2 years ago for the critical habitat revisions, and next September, the Fish and Wildlife Service will propose once again, and we hope that those protections are bolstered. We hope it includes the Ocklawaha River. We hope it includes places of the Indian River Lagoon to provide substantive protections, not just the manatee, but all of the species that inhabit it, all of our fish species, our sea turtles, our dolphins, everyone who relies on this habitat.
Yeah, it's a special place, the fact that manatee is out there like it is protecting those places from being developed into, you know, motels and hotels and things that are not going to look right along the Indian River.
Exactly. That's what's so important about these critical habitat designations. Species can have millions of acres designated as their critical habitat. And once that's designated, federal agencies can't take any action that adversely modifies that critical habitat. So it protects that habitat not just for the species, but for everything else that lives there and for, you know, the Florida tourism economy and folks who rely on it as well. So that piece of legislation extends much further than just the species at hand.
But yet the Florida panther, they can't agree on a critical habitat.
And for a lot of species. I mean, it's inherently becomes politicized, especially when critical habitat could be in an area of anticipated development. You know, we've seen with the Florida panther and the gopher tortoise, their main threats are development, you know, rapid, unfettered development.
Well, it's like I was talking to you on the phone yesterday, a friend of mine picked up on the fact that Charlie Cook picked up on the fact that projects, development projects now moving closer, more inland, you know, to the east part of the panther's habitat, so to speak, and they're allowing development on the edge of, like, on one side of the street is the Florida Panther Wildlife Refuge, and on the other side of the street is a development of homes and everything, and you know, the animal runs across the road, you know, that's one of the ways they get killed, you know, but we're trying to get into parity with the developers. Mm-hmm. What the developers are doing to Florida, we're almost, it's almost as if we're trying to get parity for the endangered species along their paths. And I think that's a very dangerous thing, man, right there. Mm-hmm. You know,
and it's been a long-standing conflict. You know, it's not new, but the development has been chipping away. We refer to it as the death by a thousand cuts. And mm-hmm. there are some species, like the Miami tiger beetle, who may be down to its last cut. You know, we have 2 known populations of the Miami tiger beetle, and development is threatening its largest population. Mm-hmm. And part of why the Endangered Species Act is so important is there's 2 underpinning factors to everything. The best available science mandate, that whenever an agency makes a decision, whether it's to allow development or in designating critical habitat or listing a species, it has to use the best available science in making that decision. And the second part is the citizen suit provision. That's not just job security for myself, but it also provides a check on these agencies. Mm-hmm. The Endangered Species Act allows any citizen to sue on behalf of a species whenever an agency decision doesn't follow the best available science, for example. And the Center for Biological Diversity and other great organizations in this area consistently employ that citizen suit provision, whether it's with the manatee, the Florida panther, the tiger beetle, or countless other species, to provide a check on the agency when they don't make the right call for the species and for our environment.
And you guys are involved in I guess it's been a couple years now, suit involving the state of Florida being given the Section 404 authority. And so that had a recent development I saw where I guess there's a couple of development proposals that are having public meetings coming up that you guys were trying to get a temporary restraining order, and I can't remember what the other, whatever, but yeah, so that was involving the Endangered Species Act as well. So how does, you want to explain like Section 404 and how the Endangered Species Act plays into that and what's going on with all that?
Sure. So the state of Florida has been delegated extensive authority under the Clean Water Act, both 402, which is what we call these NPDES permits under the Clean Water Act. That's Piney Point is probably a very notable example, or 404, when wetlands and others are involved. And that essentially means the federal government, the EPA and others, have let the state of Florida just do what they please here in the state. And I think it's become clear over time, whether it's due to the mismanagement of Piney Point by the Florida Department of Environmental Protection or the unfettered development under 404, Florida has proven that it is not up to that responsibility. It has failed as its job and as a regulator. And, you know, folks have sought to increase federal agency involvement, to have a check on Florida, to make sure that the feds can come in when necessary to ensure that the right decision is being made. And I think you see in Collier County with some of the development in panther habitat, the right decisions have not been made for these species who are on the brink of extinction.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these two developments at issue just seem really bizarre, where, like, even the even the EPA is, like, by their own logic, they're saying there's going to be, like, 17 incidental takes of panthers on the one development just in the construction, and then anticipating that much every year going forward. And they're like, but it doesn't present a threat to the panther's existence, which just doesn't make sense to me when there's so few of them left and they're like, it's going to kill more than a dozen every year. That doesn't seem good.
Completely agree. Yeah. Completely agree. And you mentioned road mortality as being one of the key issues to Panthers. Mm-hmm. We're seeing road mortality down a little bit this year in Panther numbers. It's still awful every time it happens, but it's interesting when you see numbers down like that, you have to wonder why.
Yeah.
Right? We don't have fewer drivers on the road. We don't have increased protections or the stopping of development at this point. So the natural conclusion likely is that there are fewer Panthers to be hit on the roadways. And that's a sad reality that comes along with that statistic.
Yeah.
It's a species just like the manatee that needs increased protections. It needs protection of its habitat moving forward. These species cannot survive if they do not have a home. And that's something that is common sense to everyone, but it seems to sometimes slip through our regulators and our decision makers.
How is the health of the panther and the manatee generally, the health? I mean, they're both of them, the habitats are tainted. Florida panthers are, I think there's new diseases out there. And the manatee, you know, if it's floating around in polluted water, you know.
Exactly. Well, I guess to speak on the manatee specifically, you have problems on both the west and east coasts facing the manatee right now. We saw in the wake of Piney Point the horrific red tide that killed more than 600 tons of marine life in Tampa Bay alone. And you have on the east coast, nutrient pollution is fueling blue-green algae. We lost in the Indian River Lagoon over the span of 2009 to 2019, more than 90% of its seagrass. I mean, that is ecological collapse at its finest. And there are many
species. That's a big area.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And that's why we lost so many manatees. Of the more than 1,100 that died in 2021, half of those came from that one water body. You know, and this is on the heels of the downlisting of the manatee and the severe cutting of the manatee recovery program at a time where we needed manatee recovery efforts as much as we could. So we have lawsuits and we've employed the Endangered Species Act to try to curb nutrient pollution in the Indian River Lagoon. And we're hopeful that the state of Florida and the EPA can set better criteria for how many nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus mainly, are allowed to be dumped into that lagoon every single year.
Well, since it seems like everybody is in agreement that the animal should go back on the Endangered Species Act, why are we dragging our feet?
Well, I think there's some natural feet dragging that has to take place with our government. I think we've all wrapped our heads around that at a certain point. We did have a great first step in that direction on our petition. There's what's supposed to be a 90-day finding on a petition that basically says the petition satisfies all the requirements under the Endangered Species Act. It presents substantial information that the action may be warranted, which basically means it looks good. You gave some compelling arguments. And unfortunately, in the Endangered Species Act, there's language that says 90 days to the maximum extent practicable, which, if you can't read between the lines there, that means you're not getting it within 90 days. It's like a friend telling you that I might come to that party on Friday. they're not showing
right,
up.
Right.
So we got that finding at 290 days after the threat of litigation, and it was positive. It said that the action may be warranted, and now the Fish and Wildlife Service has to embark on their own calculus, looking at the information that we and Harvard and others provided to them, as well as their own modeling, to determine if the manatee merits uplisting. And that's due this winter. And we hope that we're going to have an uplisting. And moreover, we hope that uplisting results in substantive changes, that we get more allocations. We have more full-time employees dedicated to manatee recovery efforts. This is a species that needs it. And this is a populace that wants it. You know, so it's the right decision to make, and we hope that that'll come quickly.
Have you seen any movement on the way that the EPA regulates the gypsum stacks? Like, because what happened at Piney Point is not a one-time event. It actually happens all over the state. And have you guys been able to either see any movement or with Fish and Wildlife and with your work change how the EPA regulates how they dismantle these phosphogypsum mines and what we're left with in the state of Florida?
That is such an important question, and unfortunately, the answer is no. In the wake of Piney Point, which was a monumental disaster, the Environmental Protection Agency has not changed anything about the way it regulates these phosphogypsum stacks. You know, we have a lawsuit right now pending over Piney Point, and it's generating a Clean Water Act permit for the site. The site operated without a permit for more than a decade, mm-hmm. and this incident happened while it was permitless.
And that was after the original company left, right?
Yes.
Because they make these shell corporations take all their money and leave, and then they leave the original or the other company behind to clean it up, which has no funding.
Well, exactly. Yeah, and Piney Point, I mean, from its inception when it was like, what, Mulberry or whatever, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just been pollutant and terrible stuff since like the 60s. So. Oh.
You now have two owners who have gone bankrupt after environmental catastrophe at that site, and that should be enough to tell the Environmental Protection Agency that something is not right in the state of Florida. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection is not regulating. So someone must step in to do so.
Yeah, and, like, if anything, they're going the opposite direction with Mosaic's, their one fossil gypsum stack that had the sinkhole in it, and they petitioned to expand that. And,
the new whales facility.
That's going to be great for all the manatees and all the wildlife in Florida.
There are more gypsum stacks in Florida than any other state, I believe.
I think our highest point of elevation in the state is a gypsum stack.
Yeah. Right, could be. Yeah, when you drive over through... My wife and I drove over to it's the gardens over there in the middle of the state. They do concerts, and they have the big Carillon Bell Tower.
Oh, Bachman Gardens.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Oh, my God, it's beautiful. But, yeah, you get a very close-up view of, if you take the country road, you get a very close-up view of those stacks. And, you know, coming into an election year, there's always a lot of talk about how taxpayer money is spent. And I'm just reading on Sarasota Magazine here about the Piney Point, $100 million to clean that up. And that's going to come from the company that dug the hole, right? That's going to come from the phosphate companies? No? It's going to be taxpayer money?
That will not be coming from the bankrupt phosphate companies.
Right, right. And it reminds me of the song Seminole Wind. Dig for silver and dig for gold and leave the empty hole.
Yeah.
What we were left was a 23 gypsum stacks around the state. And I don't know any. Do you know anybody that worked for a phosphate company, Pete? I mean, you know, certain factories, industries, you know, employ thousands of people and, you know, create good paying jobs and all that, and that's great, but I don't know anyone who works for...
We remember John Prine wrote about the world's largest shovel.
Mm-hmm.
It's right out there in Central Florida. Yeah,
I wrote it all down as the progress of...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a question. So how can a listener, someone listening today, or anyone that comes across your work with the Center of Biological Diversity, support your guys' work for the manatees and other species?
Sure. Well, selfishly, I have to add that as a nonprofit, we function on donors and supporters. You know, we have a free supporter and membership. You can sign up for our emails, and we consistently send action alerts letting people know what's happening. We mentioned some development in Collier County a moment ago. We also consistently send action alerts out to our folks. The manatee petition is a great example. We had more than 11,000 folks within a week submit comments to the Fish and Wildlife Service saying that uplisting is merited. You know, we consistently keep folks engaged with what's happening. And when folks are mobilized, the agencies do listen. You know, they want to govern to a populace. And when thousands and thousands of people show that they care about something, you know, the agencies do listen from time to time. And if they don't, if they're not following the best available science, then luckily we go back to those citizen supervisions. So signing up, getting email alerts, you know, doesn't take any resource expenditure. And then, of course, as all good nonprofit employees, I must say that we do love donations whenever they can come in.
Well, I think back to when I first moved over here and started hanging out with Bobby Hicks. He would go to these meetings because we had these tremendous spills in the Peace River and other rivers that turned them white, you know, because of the phosphate spills and everything. And he would go to those meetings, and he would, you know, he's a big guy, he's a big biker, and he'd walk in there, and he would threaten them. He would just basically say, you know, come on, man. I'm the only Bobby Hicks in the phone book. Come on and take me on, you know. And they were afraid of him. They were afraid of him.
So you need an enforcer.
But then on the other hand, you had Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, a little tiny lady, that she would get up there. And, of course, no one would dare talk back to her. They wouldn't talk back to her. She'd say her thing. A lot of it had to do with the Florida panther. She compared it to her cats, the way the cats, you know, crawled around and stalked their little lizards and prey, and then just the same way that the panther does, you know. If someone dared talk back to her or say something, then there was somebody in the audience that would, you know, grab them and pull them outside, you know. That's how those were the early days of the of citizen involvement in environmental.
And it's still incredibly important. And you have to remember that the science is on our side. Yeah. You know, it's on the side of environmentalists who want to see the environment protected. We have another very important issue right now in DeSoto County, in the Peace River watershed. The Mosaic Company wants to build another mine. You know, it's clear that they want to expand their mining operations into southwest Florida, and all of the toxic radioactive waste from that mine would be shipped directly to the New Wales facility, the struggling New Wales facility that's had four major sinkholes and two liner tears in the last few years. You know, it's important whenever the county commissioners consider these items that they're not just swayed by the development companies or by this Fortune 500, you know, company that made $3.8 billion in net revenue last year. Yeah, the citizens come out to these commission meetings, that they speak respectfully and with the science at their backs to be able to inform the commissioners that this is not what we want.
Well, just on a small version of that, when the Pulte Homes wanted to build 44 townhomes on one of the last pieces of sand pine habitat, pristine, full of gopher tortoises in
Pinellas County,
you know, in Pinellas County, and once Tim and I went out there and videotaped the bulldozer, the tracks that the bulldozer made, running over endangered land like Rosemary Bald,
yeah, burying gopher tortoise burrows.
Yeah, and then we went home and copied that and sent it out to every county commissioner, every city commissioner, newspapers, whatever else. And pretty soon you started getting people out there at the corner, busy corner.
Yeah, Virginia and Keene.
Virginia and Keene, and with signs and saying, you know, save the Douglas property, as the owner who died wanted it to be saved as a park, you know. And it is
a park now.
And it is, yeah.
It's a great example of how citizen involvement can actually affect a change.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely.
Because that was not turned into a development. It's still beautiful.
Not just citizen involvement, but that also was a nice, where you had local, state, and federal funds all coming together with citizen support. It was just, a really good, like, just best case scenario for how these things can go.
Yep. And a couple wealthy benefactors came up with a couple $1 million to seal the deal.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We've got a lot of people listening on Facebook this morning.
Oh, yeah, we haven't made a single Facebook announcement.
Yeah, I've been watching all these wonderful comments come
Goody
in.
And Mac Martin and Bark and Barney and Terry Pavinsky and Mark Schofield and Bill Paris, Gary Harrell, Dale Stanton. Good morning, Dale. Jay Kolb, Chadwick Smith, Douglas Lichterman, L.A. Moore, Daryl Clinton, and hundreds of others, I'm sure.
Yes, millions.
Bill Paris was really happy. He heard the Jim Belew song as he tuned in. And then Dale shared a really nice story about the chickens.
Another finger picker, Bill Paris. Yeah. Jim Belew, you know. Yeah.
So, Reagan, is there a website or something that where people can donate if
Sure. Yeah, the Center for Biological Diversity. You can, look us up online. There's a very robust website that has a lot of the alerts to what we're doing. You know, I am based in the St. Petersburg office. We focus a lot on Florida specific issues, but we have offices all across the nation. And as you know, endangered species and wild lands are important across the nation. So, you know, subscribe. See what we have on the website and stay apprised of what's going on both in your neck of the woods and across the nation.
All right. Listen, thanks so much for coming down. And
yeah, we really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
See if there's any questions or anything that anybody has. You want to stick around a little bit? Maybe somebody comes up with a question out there in Radio Land. Give it to it. Give us a chat on the Facebook page. Which is
Florida Folk Show Facebook group. Florida Folk Show Sunshine 96.7.
There you go.
Reagan, is there any way that citizens like us could urge the state agencies, because right now, you know, state versus federal, city versus county, you know, is there any way we can get the Florida DEP to actually protect the environment?
Yeah, there are a lot of ways. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission consistently has commission meetings all across the state. We like to show out to those meetings to to inform them of what the public wants. And they do truly listen from time to time,
I must
add. And then the Florida Department of Environmental Protection is the same. You know, they are problematic agencies that have good people working daily. And they do listen when they have to. And there are, if you follow our website and others, we consistently reach out with action alerts to folks when comment windows are available, when meetings are being held in your area. And the more people that can come out, the better, because it really is important.
Right. Good. I don't, you know, they kneecapped a lot of agencies, I think, starting with our former governor. When words like climate change and global warming are outlawed, literally, you can't say them or print them on any state, you know, business, that's not good.
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is back in the early days of the Panther movement, the enemy were the drug smugglers. Oddly enough, that place was just packed with drugs, and that's where a major entree point into the United States was right through the Everglades there. And you'd go out in the swamp out there, and you'd see full roads, runways built in the middle of nowhere.
Developments that never happened, have all the streets paved out, but no houses built.
The old Golden Gate, you know, And these guys, you know, they were very anti. It was dangerous. You know, the game commission and people on the committee out there looking for panthers, they had to be armed. You know, and it just that doesn't exist now. You know, the same signs are up. We were just down there a couple weeks ago, and you know, slow down. You know, 25 at night, that type of thing. You know, but it's a different world. The attitude is not there against the people trying to save the animal.
Well, and that's, again, why the Endangered Species Act is so important. We have a pivotal Supreme Court case back from the 70s, TVA v. Hill. And in that, the Supreme Court says that in enacting the Endangered Species Act, Congress intended to afford endangered species the highest of priorities. That means there is no higher priority than the conservation of life on Earth, and that's what the Endangered Species Act has stood for 50 years now.